Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. American history is fascinating. We have so many different levels of it. There's so many different expressions that we can relate to. But many times we forget that what makes a nation great are the people that live within it. Everyday people that most of the time we won't hear anything about. And we're going to be tiptoeing back into history with two people today, Ted Haynes and Grace Vandevert McNellis. And we're going to be talking with them about an aspect of history that many people are not even close to understanding anything about. It's going to be taking place in my home turf, you might say, the Pacific Northwest. We're going to be talking about the early days of Oregon and a family that came out to the Pacific Northwest, never imagining that the ranch that they would establish would eventually become a historic site. I want to welcome Ted Haynes and Grace Vandevert McNellis to the show. Welcome, both of you.
Oh, thanks.
Hello, Donna. Good to talk to you.
Well, Ted, it is a real joy to have both of you on the line. Now, Grace, you are a member of the Vandevert family. You currently live in Gig Harbor, Washington. Ted Haynes, you have a very strong association with the Vandevert Ranch. You need to give us a little bit of history about how you became involved with this ranch, which is now, what, 118 years old, and how you connected up with Grace.
Okay. Well, Grace, of course, was born on the ranch and grew up there. And when it was still owned by the Vanderverts and was still a cattle ranch. And when they sold it, it was developed into a ranch with 20 home sites on it and still a lot of other acres in common. And my wife and I bought a lot there on the Little Deschutes River, about 16 miles south of Bend, in 1995, and finally built a house that we finished in 2007. And I became very interested in the history of the ranch, as Gracie had been, and Gracie had been collecting not only her memories, but many documents about the ranch for a very long time. So we put some of the history on a website for the ranch, VandevertRanch.org, and then we decided to write a book together. And we had a lot of fun doing it.
That was good.
Mm-hmm. And Gracie was a great resource and a great writer, and we had a great time, and the book has been very successful, Vandevert, the 100-year history of a Central Oregon ranch.
This is something that when I was going through the book and I was reading the book, it brought to mind the fact that within a relatively short period of time, we have gone from an era where women, instead of cleaning, clothes by boiling them, or, very, what we call very primitive today, God knows I bless my washer and dryer every day I use it. I think, because I know what it's like to have to do stuff by hand, when I think of the way people had to live and how your family, Grace, had such a sense of adventure. When you look at your ancestors and you look at the way you're living today, it's quite a shock, isn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Now, Grace, may I ask your age?
I'm 88, almost 89.
Congratulations. Well, it's delightful that you and Ted got together to put this information out there, because it portrays an essence of the American history that I think is so very, very important. Now, you start off with what its very first chapter, The Bear Hunter, and that was William Plutarch Vandervoort.
Right.
And this is in the 1800s. So we're stepping back in time to 1854. He was born in Cottage Grove, Oregon, which is a wonderful community. I have a very dear friend that actually lives in Cottage Grove. So with this, with what you got in the way of research, Ted, when you were going back and forth with Grace on this information, how did you feel when you were putting all of this together? Did you feel like you were stepping back into a time zone that you know you will never, ever see?
Oh, very much so. You know, Central Oregon, where this is located, was very hard to get to and was very unsettled, even in 1892 when Bill Vandervoort founded the ranch, and he was really out in the wilderness all on his own. And Bend, which is a city of 90,000 people today, the population back then was about 20. And, of course, it wasn't even a city.
Mm-hmm.
And because the Vandervoorts had 8 children, Bill and Sadie had 8 children, the population of the ranch was almost as big as the population of Bend.
True.
It was a pretty brave thing to do, and I don't know how Sadie put up with it. She was from Kentucky, from Louisville, I think, and a relatively civilized place. And she followed this man out into the wilderness to raise cattle, and God bless them both.
Absolutely. Those that came out west, really, as far as I was concerned, were pretty gutsy people. But with what was so significant to me, we're talking about the late 1800s, and Indians still were attacking settlers, but there was a little bit of back history, because there was a woman by the name of Grace Clark Vandervoort that came across and along the Oregon Trail in 1851, and there was a Shoshone warrior. His name was Has No Horse. And they had a whole bunch of horses, and they were attacked, and a number of the family were killed. She was, what, the only survivor?
No, her brother, Thomas Clark, survived, but her mother and her brother were both killed in the raid.
Yep, and they're buried there.
Mm-hmm.
They're buried there. So here we are. Again, that's not that long ago that the Wild Wild West, if you will, existed. Now, Grace, your family had what you describe as pioneering blood. There just seemed to be that essence in them.
It's a little hard to hear her. Could she tune up a little bit or not?
Well, I'm not going to be able to tune up anymore.
There you are. That's
okay.
A little better.
All right. That's good. All right. So what I wanted to say is that the pioneering blood was very strong in your family.
Yes.
And it just seemed to be with all of you. I mean, you even picked up and went to new places. This just seemed to be a part of the family that still resides in so many of you.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, a great
well, it was an interesting place. It was an interesting family.
Well, that's for sure. Now, let's talk about a little bit of the interesting characters. There was a story by Zane Grey called The Hash Knight Outfit.
Right.
How did your family know about this? How did they know about this?
About the Hash Knife brand.
Well, it was the brand because my grandpa brought it to the ranch from Arizona, where he had worked with the Hash Knife Outfit.
So that's
and so when they left Arizona, he and Sadie came up to take over the ranch, which they had purchased by then.
Well, they had eventually five children.
They what?
They had eventually five children.
Well, they had, my dad was born before in Prineville, just, 30 miles from the ranch, on their way to the ranch. And then Grace was born after they got to the ranch. And then there was the youngest brother was born, too. They came up with, I think, five kids, but it ended up they had eight children.
All right. Now, Bill Vander...
I've got dates of when they were born, all that kind of thing, if you need it.
Well, I'm not going to need that at this time.
Okay.
Bill Vandervoort.
Yes.
He was the bear hunter, and he really gained a huge reputation because he killed the Silver Lake grizzly.
That's right.
So what happened? Why was this grizzly bear so significant?
I think because there were so few of them, but don't quote me because I'm not positive. But it really, well, there was a gentleman down in California, a writer for a local newspaper, who wrote the story up because I think he was with Grandpa when he killed the grizzly bear.
Well, I think what happened, some other hunters had wounded the bear. And
that
chased it into a canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that may be. Yeah, go ahead.
So Bill Vandervoort went into this canyon. He was a very young man, I think, at that time.
Yeah, a teenager.
And to face this very angry grizzly bear. In narrow quarters. So it was very risky. But he liked hunting, and
he loved to go out.
He came out of the canyon, and the bear didn't. So
I know he loved that part of his life.
Yeah,
I used to listen to him tell stories about. That was just something. Thank goodness I got to listen to a little bit, and it was fascinating.
The area that they chose to live in was near Crater Lake. Am I correct?
Oh, it's about at least 100 miles north of Crater Lake. But with so few people around, there was hardly anybody between them and Crater Lake.
Now, the growing season there in that area was not very long. It sort of reminds me of Alaska, that you just had a very short growing season. And there were certain foods that grew very well. But, Grace, when you were growing up,
yes,
you didn't think twice about what you had to do, and it was just a part of your life, wasn't it?
To do what?
Well, like churning butter. You talked about the butter churn.
We had no electricity, no running water, but we had a good pump. But we managed. We knew what to do, and people came there. We always had gatherings, family gatherings. We knew how to put a meal on the table. My mother could do anything, baked and did all that kind of thing. We managed.
On a wood stove, which is not easy to cook on.
Oh, it was a wood stove, and it's down in the Historical Society now. And yes, and then we finally got electricity and things like that, and that was fun to plug an iron in and actually have it heat on the ironing board rather than on the stove. I mean, there's a lot to that, but I won't go into a lot of detail on it. I'm just saying that was great fun when we did manage to get lights in the house.
Oh, yes, that and the telephone as well. But...
And the telephone had been there since early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on a party line with about four other families that went up to Lapine and back towards Bend, places down where Sun River is. Now we all had phones, and we left messages if we had to be gone to ask people to take our phone call. If they heard a long and too short, would they please answer it and get a message so that we could get it when we got home. And we did the same for them.
Isn't it amazing when you think we're in 2018.
Yes.
This was in the 1930s in the center of Oregon, and you had the telephone service before you actually got electricity. And I think
we did have a phone. It was in Bend, but we just rang the old phone, and an operator in Bend would answer us and ring the number we wanted.
Look at the changes in technology in less than 100 years. It's just absolutely amazing.
We don't even know what a big old telephone like that looks like. Yeah. Ted knows.
Well, thanks to Gracie, I still have that phone.
He's got the old phone from the ranch, and I'm thrilled that he has it because it'll be cared for. Yeah.
Yes, and they really are collector's items today, big time.
They're interesting. I've had local telephone guys where I live come in and look at it, and they just said, "You got to be kidding." You know, I mean, it's just been a fun thing.
Yes, it has.
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to get into that.
Not a problem. Now, Ted, one of the things that you bring out in the book is, and this has to do with the environment, there are many species that have come and gone in that area, and you talk about this in the book Vandevert, The 100-Year History of a Central Oregon Ranch. How has the environment changed? What was it like? And then how is it today? I understand cougars are coming back into the area.
A little bit, yeah. Bears are not coming back, but there certainly were some around there when the Vandeverts got there. And a lot of the forest around the ranch, not right at the ranch, but around the ranch, was enormous old ponderosa pine.
Right.
And that was really good for timber. So what made Bend grow and so successful was the railroad came in 1911, and the mill, they built big lumber mills in 1916, and they were some of the largest lumber mills in the world up until about 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they cut down all those big, enormous ponderosas. So the ponderosas were replanted by the Forest Service, and they're growing back. But they're not like the giants yet that were once there. But at the ranch, you know, the ranch has a lot of they didn't have many deer or elk in the past because people shot them.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But now there are deer there all the time and elk frequently. There's a big elk herd that hangs out in the horse pasture. It's funny to see the horses and the elk trying to get along with each other.
That's right.
And there are quail all over the ranch now that are not native because people brought them to Central Oregon in the 1930s so they could hunt quail.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh, I haven't seen them. Go ahead.
Now, one of the points that you bring out, and this is going back to a particular period of history. This is early history. Chief Paulina. This was someone that has been, you might say, venerated with different statues, but Grace, you said he really wasn't a very nice man.
Who is this again?
Chief Paulina.
Chief Paulina, excuse me.
Chief Paulina.
Mm-hmm.
Bad man.
Yes. Ted, why was he such a bad man?
He liked to kill people. He killed my grandpa's uncle down near the Prineville area. I can't give you an exact, but it was written up, and I've got things about it. Killed them, or burned their home down, I should say. Mm-hmm. Burned the home down. And then some of the Prineville people went after him. And they found him and got rid of him. That was the end of Chief Paulina.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a picture of him at the ranch. My dad had a picture of him in our living room. And we gave it back to the Paulina Lake Lodge. We said, we really don't need this in our home anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we gave him Chief's picture.
Mm-hmm. But for being such a bad man, he has more places in Oregon named after him than just about anybody else.
The Paulina Mountains,
yeah.
Paulina Prairie, there's loads of Paulina places, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Schooling. The one-room schoolhouse was very, very prevalent. Central yes. Oregon, though, in the story, was one of the last frontier areas in the United States. And when I say frontier, I mean it was really frontier. You still were contending with Indians when the rest of the U.S. wasn't necessarily. There were the amenities that had been brought into other areas of the United States that hadn't been brought in. One-room schoolhouse was still going on. And when I was reading this, it reminded me of a relative of mine that lived in Texas. And he was in a one-room schoolhouse. And it was not unlike what you described, one teacher teaching a number of grades. And there was one time when you were, along with one other student, I think, the only two students in a certain grade. What was this like being in a one-room schoolhouse where everybody of different grade levels were engaged? This is something in today's world we wouldn't even consider.
Well, yeah, I was there for my first and second grade, and my brother actually got a diploma for graduating from high school there. Well, no, I beg your pardon. He only got through about the ninth grade there, and then we went to Lapine, a big school. But the thing about the little schoolhouse was you worked to keep that thing going. My brother would leave the house and walk across the field and get the fire started in the big stove so we could have some warmth, especially in the winter time. And we took our lunch with us. We made a lunch. My brother and I made lunches and put them in paper bags, took them to the school, and we'd always bring a can of soup and share it with the teacher. You know, that because she came from Bend, she would drive up, and except during real cold parts of the winter, then she'd come and live with us upstairs. We had a bedroom set aside for her. But we made sure she had warm food to eat at lunchtime during the bad weather. And there would be maybe three or four other kids at a time with Claude and I, with my brother and I, and then maybe they would move on. They might be woodcutter's children or something else, or there'd be a couple more come in, and we would have some of the Daly family went to school with my brother, but I was too young yet, because they live just where the golf course is, close to the schoolhouse that's there now. And so, to make a long story short, there were changes, but we loved going to school.
Mm-hmm.
We loved, the teachers were great, and we had a man teacher our last year there, Mr. Hunnell. His brother owned a car agency in Bend. And he was so good to us, and would go out and play at at lunchtime. We had a baseball. It was a great time. And he was a teacher for 1 year, and then we closed the school. And then they waited until my brother Dave was old enough to go to school. He hadn't started yet. He was young yet.
Now, there was one of the members of family. Actually, there were a couple of members of your family that became doctors. And
doctors?
That became doctors.
Yes,
and
there were three of them. My dad's three brothers.
Your dad's three brothers. And one of them was very important because he taught young mothers how to use a baby formula. Now, today,
that's Uncle George.
Okay, that's your Uncle George.
That's
so,
Dr. George Vandervoort. He had an office down in the Bay Area in California, and he went back, took extra classes back in New York, and learned how to. That baby formula, that canned milk was the best thing to use for babies.
Mm-hmm.
You bought the cans of milk and mixed it with water and made baby formula.
I found it
because there was a Shevlin camp where there were people lived that were in the cutting the trees down, all that. They were losing babies.
Yes, big time.
And nobody understood why a mother would lose a baby. Well, it was because they were using raw milk. And raw milk was not what you give a new baby. I sure learned that when I had babies in later years. I made sure I had the canned milk on hand.
I find it really intriguing that at that time, and milk was not pasteurized, but was caused contamination. What caused contamination was that milk cans would be filled, and then they'd be left out in the sun, so bacteria would develop.
It was not a good, you know, way to handle things in those days. We look back now and kind of shudder, and when there's a new baby, you know, we know nowadays we don't have to worry about that. We've got doctors that tell new mothers, hey, this is the way you do it now.
Mm-hmm. Also, I was intrigued to learn that there was almost no cattle disease. Ted, this is something that was really quite amazing to me, because anyone that has been involved in the dairy industry or in raising cattle, there's always the concerns for disease. This is something that vets, dependent on the area that they go in. But Ted, why is it there was not cattle disease in Central Oregon? What made this a place?
We raised the food they ate, and we took them down to a place called Spring River, just to the north of the ranch, a couple miles and across the river. And they had good food, and we also took a cake of salt to them. They had salt to eat. I don't know if that helps any to figure out, but they needed salt, and we provided it.
Well, I think part of it also was the altitude was fairly high, 4,000 feet.
Yes,
and,
yes, it is.
It hadn't been cattle country, and it hadn't been farm country.
No, it hadn't.
It had been forest, and a lot of what around it was still forest. So they didn't associate with a lot of other cattle, and I don't think the environment kind of harbored most of those diseases.
No, we never found a dead calf or a cow, one of the cattle that couldn't get back to the ranch. They were so glad to get back. They would almost run because they knew where they were going when we'd go pick them up. They had about 3 miles. To enjoy, and then we turned them into the pasture and started feeding them the hay that we had gotten while they were gone, and in the barn we fed them, and we put I'm trying to think what it was, molasses. We got a small barrel of molasses, and I'd forgotten about that, but we heated it in the winter time and poured it on the shocks of hay so the cattle would not only get their hay, but they would get some good stuff into their bodies. Molasses evidently was good for them. I never really discussed it with my dad, but boy, we fed them those molasses just like we did the salt in the summertime.
The Depression.
That's about all I can tell you about it.
Mm-hmm. The Depression was really hard for millions of people across the nation.
Oh, yes.
You stated that you always had food to eat. You had sheep, had chickens, you had some cows, you had eggs. So,
and at one time,
So all of this was readily available, and the Pacific Northwest is known as, for those historians that research it.
Oh, that's good.
For having such an abundance of food, the Native Americans that lived here, different groups, they were just amazingly strong and healthy because of the fish and the various edible foods came on bushes and in roots.
Oh, there were bad times.
Mm-hmm. So the depression, you said you were poor, but you didn't know it. Now, cattle, this is something we were just discussing. But with the cattle, eventually they were sold because there was that period, and it was because of the Second World War, if I'm correct, where the military came in and bought over 5,500 acres. Ted, let's talk about that. What was it that created a huge shift? Because Central Oregon, as you mentioned, was very, very difficult to get to, but there was something that was developed there by the military where they requisitioned 5,500 acres of land. That's a huge amount of land.
Mm-hmm. Well,
they got it. They had it.
Well, near the ranch, they had a camp that trained engineers to go to Europe and build bridges and build roads.
Camp Abbott.
And Camp Abbott. And that, you know, that was a sudden burst in population of the area.
Exactly.
It was an enormous thing to descend on this rural area. But the other thing in Central Oregon was, you know, the skies are clear almost all the time. So it was a great place to train pilots. And I think that was further north, but in the same general area. And I know Gracie used to spot planes for the military. I don't think she expected to see a Japanese or German plane flying over, but
no,
anyhow, she
but
was supposed to spot the plane.
Where they went.
Yeah.
No, they were Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
But they could get more training time in because
right.
these guys
they
were clear.
They went to Redmond. They went to the Redmond area, I think, to land and to take off and what have you. But we watched them and called Redmond to tell them what direction it was flying, where it was, making sure that it was headed towards Redmond. And my mother and I and my dad did it sometimes. That's what we did. We did. That was part of our being good for the, you know, helping with the war effort.
Fascinating. Also, there are a couple of points of history. The old frontier went with the Golden Spike. That's what,
yes.
In Bend, Oregon, that's a part of history that used to be taught in school about how the railroad made such a difference.
That was a big deal.
But also, the stagecoach. The time frame on the stagecoach and the fact that the stagecoach was still running in the early 1900s, that I had no clue about. That is something that
I saw it long before I was born.
Just amazing.
But it was a big deal. I mean, there were routes all over Oregon and daily routes and different companies competing for it. There were stagecoaches all over the place. It was amazing. And there was a town near the ranch that was founded and thought it was going to be prosperous because the stagecoach stopped between Lapine and Bend.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it stopped, and they had a hotel and a restaurant, and they thought,
this is
going to be
great.
Yeah,
very close to the ranch.
And then all of a sudden the automobile came along, and nobody needed to stop.
And
the town's completely gone now.
And it was gone, what, by 1905, the stagecoach?
Oh, I think it was later than that.
You think it was later than that?
It was called Harper. It was called Harper, and I think it disappeared around 1919.
Harper was what it was called someplace. I won't get it now, but I'm just, and I didn't know about it, but there's remains of it still.
Mm-hmm.
You can go in and actually find where they had a place for people to stay overnight. Where horses, they had a barn for the horses to stay over so they could, morning kind of thing. And
Is
he still there?
I'm still here, hon. Yeah.
Okay, the phone kind of did a funny, I think somebody's trying to get somebody on the phone. And Ted, are you still there?
Oh, I'm still here, yeah.
Oh, there. Okay, then we're okay. But there was a buzz like somebody trying to call.
Well, that's what the new innovations do sometime.
Yes. Yes, they do, I guess.
The women, like your mother and other women, to put up meat. You said that, Grace, that there was a lot of mutton that you ate when you were growing up, but beef was really enjoyed. And this is something that your mother would actually can meat? Because you didn't have a refrigerator for a long time.
We had a refrigerator, but didn't carry ice. Was there no ice for it?
But the refrigerator came in later, because in the stories that you have in here, your family used to cut ice during the winter and then cover it with sawdust.
Across the river where Ted lives, and brought it into the house.
Yes. There's so many things. I really wanted to touch on something that affects us today very, very strongly. And it was about Pearl. And Pearl, after she graduated from high school, she used a comptomerator. I've never heard of that. It was a machine.
A console.
Comparator?
Yes, I think that's what it is.
Oh, yes, that's what she went to work for, a place that had those comptometer things or something.
And that was a precursor to the computer we have today.
Exactly. It was in Portland. She went to work. I got to see her at the house where she grew up. And my dad met her in those days and thought she was pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go ahead and get into that now. But it was just, she thought she did a pretty good job at that job. She loved the ranch. And when she married Dad, she was very, very happy. They had a great life together.
The diseases of typhoid and tetanus were very prominent. And
typhoid and what else?
Typhoid and tetanus.
Okay.
That is something, the vaccine for tetanus, which we don't even think about today.
No.
Was invented in 1924. But it wasn't until World War II it was used, and your family lost a little boy due to tetanus. He had stepped on a nail.
That's right, he stepped on a nail.
And then
through a board once.
Yes. And also,
that was Danny.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Also, I chuckled when I was reading about the Montgomery Ward Christmas catalog. And JCPenney's, which was in Bend, Oregon.
On the corner.
And people don't realize that this was really significant for a family like yours, because you were way out in the boonies.
That's right.
The catalogs were what you ordered things through.
Yes. They came in the mail. They did send them to us, but then you ordered, but I worked for Montgomery Wards in Bend and found out what all is necessary. Just people come in and order things. It was a small office, and it was great fun because it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
That was soon after I graduated from high school.
I was amazed at how adaptable and flexible your mother was, because she one time put 20 people up in her house because the weather was so bad.
Christmas time too.
Yes, and she made breakfast, she fixed lunch.
Oh, and it was something else.
Yes, so Ted, when you were talking with Grace about these times, and you think back on it and how hard the men had to work. And it's so different today, although there are some people in farming and ranching that could really relate to a lot of this. But the average person in today's modern world just would raise an eyebrow and go, really? And it wasn't that long ago. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. How did this affect you when you were going through this, Ted, and you were talking with Grace, and you realize you're living in a place that...
Yeah, tell us the truth, Doc, Ted. What was going on in your mind? That's so funny.
Well, it's a lot easier to read a book than it is to raise cattle, I'll tell you that.
I know it, but Ted was so interested in all this history. We had a great time putting it together and doing what we've done.
No, I admired how hard they worked physical work, but at the same time, they really had to use their heads about what they were doing and how to take care of the cattle and how to get them to market and but there was a lot of risk and uncertainty because sometimes the hay that they raised, there was a lot of it, and sometimes there wasn't. And
yep, they'd have to buy it.
They'd have to go buy it to get the cattle over the winter. And you were mentioning in the Depression that Gracie's brother talked about their father. And, every fall he'd sell his cattle and pay his bills, and he'd have no money left.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, "We were poor, but we didn't know it." In a cash way, they certainly were. They had the land and the cattle, but in terms of cash, they didn't have any.
Right, and I think that is something many farmers and ranchers today mm-hmm. still have that challenge.
I know. It's tough. It's really managing a business. One of the things, it's a little off the subject, but, when Apple computers came out, some of the first buyers of them were farmers.
Mm-hmm.
They really needed them, and
mm-hmm.
they were willing to learn how to use them,
mm-hmm.
and it made a tremendous difference to them.
Oh, yes, they're using drones now to be able to keep tabs on their fields and their animals. It's really quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Also, something that is very important here in the Pacific Northwest, because we are known for all of our beautiful trees and the rainforests, etc., there was a lot of an understanding that came forth pretty fast because the timber industry was logging at such a rate that it really had affected many parts of the environment. And I think the Pacific Northwest, even today, is a leader in conservation with timber, in wanting to make sure that the waterways are kept cool because we have enough natural foliage and trees along the streams, creeks, and rivers that were cut down. And during the 1930s and 1940s, which is, again, less than 100 years ago, there was concern about this, wasn't it, Ted?
Well, there was, and Gracie can talk about driving home from Bend and seeing the forests, cut down to almost nothing and being able to see a great distance into the future.
Yeah, looking south.
But God bless the Forest Service. They replanted them, and they're coming back, and it will eventually be back,
I'm sure, I hope. Yeah.
But it takes years. It's something that takes a long period of time. Trees, dependent on their species, are mm-hmm. sort of slow growing or medium growing as far as speed goes.
Yeah. Lived to be 300 or 400 years old.
So easily.
We still got a long ways to wait.
I think so. I think so.
I don't know if I can last that long.
Well, Grace, you're doing well at 88, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks.
Your memory is so sharp.
I love those trees because we had them at the schoolhouse where you could climb up and my brother would and things like that. But there were also some beautiful ones on the ranch itself
mm-hmm.
back on the south end. And I'm trying to find one of them. I don't know if it's still there or not. One of these days I'll find it.
I was surprised to find out that your family, Grace, had a horse, and that horse's name was Pepper.
Pepper.
And also there was another horse called Queen that was a descendant of Manowar. And Manowar, oh my goodness, the history on that horse is amazing.
Well, yes.
And here's your family in the middle of Oregon having a horse that's descended from Manowar.
Well, I'll try to make it really, really quick. I had an Uncle Bill Vandervoort was a rancher just like my dad, but he moved down to Tumalo and started a farm there. But he went nuts over racehorses. And we had racing in Redmond, Oregon, at the different fairs they had. Uncle Bill bought, I don't know if he bought that one that you mentioned, but he had one, and we called her, you mentioned the name, and I'm, say those names again,
Queen
would
or,
you?
Pepper?
Pepper.
Yes.
Pepper, okay. He got a hold of Pepper, and Pepper, I think, was used in some of the in the Redmond fairs that they have once a year. Then he gave my brother Claude that horse, and it became my brother's horse, and my brother rode it. And I've got, I think I've got pictures of it someplace, I'm not sure, but in later years, and I won't go into the whole thing, but we left the ranch one day. When we came back, that horse and one other was missing from the upper pasture where we always kept them. And somebody had driven along and seen a horse and knew that it was a good, good horse. And they backed up and hauled him away. We advertised in 5 states to get him back. And Pepper was long gone. We never heard about him again. Whoever got him knew a good horse and got him a clear away from Bend and the ranch and all that. But, and my brother was heartbroken, but by then he was ready to go to work. He was getting out of school, high school, so, and that didn't happen to us much. We didn't have problems like that. But we got another horse, I think, that Claude was able to ride. My dad had a war horse. We called it a war horse. It was, had been used during World War II, and my uncle, the doctor in Bend, saw it, spotted it, grabbed it, said, send that over to my brother, and the horse came and was on the ranch, and that's what my dad, his name was Major. They called him Major because he was a war horse, and we used him until close to when Dad left the ranch. I think I honestly don't know what happened to the animals because I wasn't down there to keep track. It didn't matter because Dad would have done well with them. And Claude's horse was gone. I had a horse, and her name was Nellie, a strawberry roan, and I've got pictures of her someplace. But it was just an interesting time, and you just did what you had to do on that ranch, both summer, spring, fall, and winter. And there was lots of cold, cold weather. I saw it 46 below zero one winter.
46 below zero. Whoa.
But my dad had to go out and open up the river for the cattle and the horses to drink.
Mm.
And feed them and all that. That's another story. But I just, there was a good, bad, and the ugly sometimes.
Yes, that's true. Ted, part of the history, and we had mentioned it earlier in our discussion, was the 5,500 acres that were taken over by the military. I was intrigued with the fact that there was a small Italian and German prisoner of war camp.
Yeah.
Within
yeah.
this Camp Abbott. And Grace's dad, one thing that he could not tolerate was waste of food. And I was yeah. appalled when I found that the soldiers, with any excess food that was left over, they were burying it in the ground. This was during the Depression, and
right.
people were starving.
Well, it was during World War II, and of course the Army needed food.
And they were burying it right yeah. out between the ranch and the highway.
Well, but it was some kind of inefficiency in the Army where if you had food, the Army wouldn't send you any more. So
no.
you had to tell them the food was all gone. And so they buried it.
My goodness.
My dad had a fit.
Mm-hmm.
So then your dad took all of that food. He made a deal with the soldiers, and
right.
they ended up, a lot of it was canned food, but fresh
it
bread.
Was canned, and they were still burying it.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get it so that the next group of soldiers that came by could order anything they wanted.
Mm-hmm. And that way they wouldn't run out. They were so
That's
concerned
right.
that
and,
if.
But my dad
yeah.
figured it out, and the guys hauled it down to the ranch. We had a barrel. They threw it in the barrel. I mean, I can remember, so we bought pigs, and we fed it to the pigs. We had a great bunch of pigs.
Mm-hmm. And some of the better food you took up to people who needed the food.
Well, then we would kill a pig, and we would make sure we shared it both in our community, and we'd take it in the bin to my uncle and to my aunt and to people we knew. We would, and we'd take it to a meat market and have them cut it up, and then we would tell the meat market, now when so-and-so comes in, you give them that. Give them this package of shoulder meat or ribs or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a help to people during that darn World War II.
Absolutely. Also, the ranch became very, very well known due to films that were done. Richard
yes.
Boone, the star of Have Gun, Will Travel.
Yes,
Kirk
right.
Douglas.
Boone.
The African Queen with Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart. My gracious.
Sun River. And then people got to meet him. It was something else.
My. This ranch has so much history to it. Ted, when the ranch was sold, because Grace's dad lived to be, I believe, 94 years of age.
I think her grandfather did. I don't know that her father did.
I can tell you in a second, just a minute, I'll tell you. Grandpa lived until 1944, and my dad lived until, just a minute, I can tell you here, just, sorry, I
well,
just...
Well, she's looking it up.
Dad, where are you? Here, I've got a schedule here. Chester J.C., Mitty Thomas, where are you, Dad? Bill, I'm sorry. Go ahead and talk, because I'll get back to you.
That's great, Grace. That'll be super. Long life seems to be in the family. However, Grace's mom...
They do pretty well.
Yes, Grace's mom died. And then your dad remarried, and he was married for a number of years to a woman by the name of Jeannie. Mm-hmm. How was it, Ted, that the ranch ended up being sold? How did that evolve? Because now it is a phenomenal site for many homes, of which you have one.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, way back in 1970, they actually sold the ranch with a life estate. And the life estate meant that as members of their family could live on the ranch as long as they wanted.
As long as they lived or whatever,
and,
right?
And so... Claude's wife, Jeannie, lived there until the 1990s. But in the meantime, the ownership changed. It sold to two guys in the lumber business, and then he sold it to a guy named, Jim and Carol Gardner. And they got it for a good price, and they lived in the homestead, and they actually rebuilt the homestead, the original log house. And they loved it, but all of their guests told them how wonderful it was, and they wanted to live there too. So the gardeners decided to develop the ranch, and they put in roads. They put in a new bridge over the Little Deschutes, and they put in a gate, and they put in lots and utilities. And so they made 20 lots that take up about 50 acres, and then there's another 350 acres that's held in common. And they began to sell the lots. And they sold them, for the local people said, you can't possibly sell lots for those prices. Land around here isn't worth that much. But the fools from California, like me, and Seattle and Portland, they came out and paid the price. And but it's a very nice community now. All the houses are logged, like the original house.
Mm-hmm.
It's rural. And some very nice houses.
Well, you go into detail on how they're built, and there is so much information in this book. Vandevert, and that's V-A-N-D-E-V-E-R-T, this is 100-year history, but actually the area, you know, moved into is 118 years ago, or the equivalent thereof.
Right.
So when I went through this and I thought, here is a part of American history, people of the pioneering spirit that You have Gracie. You saw so many things that have totally disappeared today. You lived really in a fabulous environment, even though times could be tough. You didn't know anything about drugs. That wasn't around. There was not a problem with alcoholism. You were in a world, it was almost as if it was like a bubble that insulated you from a lot of things. Your life was rich. Your life was healthy. Diseases did come in. I mean, the little boy, Danny, that died that from tetanus.
It was a wonderful life.
Mm-hmm. It really, really was. And when you talk to people, Gracie, today, when you talk to people about the days, do you find that they go, wow, is that impossible? How could you have done without running water?
Oh, yeah.
All of these things.
How could you have done without a shower to take?
Yes.
We used the bathtub, thank you.
Well, in the summer, you used the river.
Right. Oh, we took baths in the river in the summertime with a bar of ivory soap. So if it floated away, we could go grab it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my heavens.
Oh, yes. Oh, we didn't bother with hot. I mean, my mother would wash my hair at the house because you needed warm water to really. But other than that, my dad and brother would go down around the bend of the river and strip down to maybe they had their bathing suit on or whatever, and maybe they didn't. And they washed and did just what I did back at the bridge by the house. And they took baths, and we were clean.
Fascinating. So many parts of...
Oh, I got my dad's birth when he passed away. Do you want his when he was born? Or is that necessary? He was born in 1892 in Prineville, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And then he died in December the 5th of 1975 in the hospital. He was in the hospital. He had diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank both of you for being my guests today on Warriors for Peace.
This is a learning experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to thank both of you. The website, for those of you listening, if you're interested in some amazing American history, VanderVertRanch.org. That's VanderVert Ranch.org.
Right.
Thank you both for being my guests. Stay with me. I'll be back with you in just a moment. But before I say goodbye to those of you that are listening, I wanted to make a comment by Virgil M. Hatcher. He said, the great value of formal education is that it's designed to foreshorten human experience. It endeavors with ease and economy to bring each succeeding generation up to date with respect to the past and to make it at home in the world. In this sense, it prepares each generation for life. The conversation we have had today depicts a time, an era that, well, we probably won't be seeing again. But if you really want to know the truth, there are many people in the world whose lifestyles and conditions are not unlike the VanderVerts. They may not have had the abundance of environment or weather or beauty surrounding them, but it's still there. This is so important for us to understand. The luxuries and the abundance that we have came about because someone said there's got to be something better. This is important for us because we need to encourage our children and their children's children to know about history. No matter where you are on this planet, your past has value. It enriches you because it shows you the tenacity and courage that it took to survive some extraordinary experiences. This publication, VanderVert, The 100-Year History of a Central Oregon Ranch, is one of those stories that makes for a fascinating read. I really hope that you will remember your legacies within your families and be sure that you share them with the generations to come. This is Donna Sebo. Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour. Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.